Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
Today we're speaking with Christian Hampson from Yerrabingan Rooftop Farm in Everleigh about the native food industry, the lack of Indigenous representation within it and possible solutions to the problem. Okay, welcome to another Food Fight podcast. My name's Steph Postuma, joined by Simon Evans.
Hello.
And we find ourselves here in the middle of Everleigh, with some birds chirping in the background, with Christian Hampson from Yerrabingan. Welcome, Christian. Thanks so much for joining
us,
mate.
Hey, Simon. Thanks.
Yeah, cool. Well, we usually start off with an acknowledgement of country, but we'll get you to say a few words for us, if you don't mind.
Yeah, Wamanjik, Mampamali Nyara, Christian, Manaru Woiwurrung, Dagabu Mianga, Gadigal Leora.
Perfect. Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah,
it's better than you normally do.
Much better, man. Much better. Christian, look, let's just get started. Tell us. Let's start with you. How did you get into this into this place? Tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I suppose I worked for over 23 years in national parks and cultural heritage. So, was really always really interested in different aspects of culture. Obviously, that was part of my role. My technical skill, I suppose, was in things like conservation of rock art, but then got in more into the overall management and working with community, and then very much kind of this idea of how do I get involved in empowering community. And I suppose working in government for a long time, I got to the point that I thought, well, this is just the wrong way to do it. So a few years ago, I went back and did my business degree at UTS and then decided that leveraging in the private space was a great way to get, you know, cultural sustainability, which is essentially embedded with environmental sustainability for us. So that was the idea, was to get into that. And then I met the director of this site through my old job, and he sort of liked the way that I operated and sort of said to us, would you guys be interested in doing some stuff here at South Everleigh to sort of bring the community back into the space, I suppose. So that was what essentially most of our projects are about.
Amazing. Cool. Well, then let's talk about Yerrabingan. Like, how did the tell us about the project first for people who haven't heard of Yerrabingan. Let's give us a brief sort of overlay of what it is.
So we're pretty lucky here. We got offered this opportunity to pitch an idea around how we might use what they call a rooftop farm. And for us, we were like, what's a rooftop farm? Does that mean they're going to have like cows? I was looking at the locomotive workshop and thinking, are they going to put cows and chickens on the roof? Why are they asking us? But when we looked at it, we actually started to be inspired by some of the rooftop spaces that are particularly First Nations people in Canada that are around cultural spaces. But we wanted to turn it on its head and bring together, you know, our approach to permaculture, which we think's been ripped off us anyway, permaculture. And sort of this idea of bringing that together, Indigenous land management knowledge and knowledge of plants, and then putting it in an interesting sort of a corporate space almost. It's like, you know, overlooked by corporate buildings, and it's like, here you go, here's something that's really weird. Someone said to us one day, is it a farm or is it a garden? I said, well, if you can't tell the difference, then it's worked.
Perfect. Yeah, so true. if people go up there, if people go onto the rooftop, what can they expect to see?
Well, we've got over 2,500 plants, over 40 species. We always say that it's 100% edible, but not all edible to humans.
Yeah.
So the idea is
not everything's obviously edible, it's tasty.
Yeah.
You can eat it.
So it's the biodiversity. So obviously having the pollinators and everything in there. Yeah, I agree. Everyone talks about edible flowers. I haven't had too many that taste good.
Yeah, yeah. They taste of flowers.
Just means it doesn't kill you.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, and then it's over, and then you've got this beautiful space here in South Heavy, overlooks Alexandria, four floors up. It's 580 square metres. A bit of an engineering exercise. These things always are. The hardest thing was to keep it on the roof, so we didn't want it to go through the roof. So the great thing is that the model we came up with can be adapted to existing roofs across the city. I mean, there must be hectares of rooftops across Sydney. So that's part of the idea is a prototype. And all the plants had never been used before in that environment. So the idea was, is here you go, we've co-designed this with the community, which is what we did use a collaborative design approach. And this is working, so we can, when people say to us, oh, you can't use these plants, we can say, well, yes, you can. Here you go, come and visit our garden.
Yeah, amazing. And then so what, when you began Yerrabingin and began this sort of endeavour, what were the original sort of goals of the farm / garden itself?
Look, I think very much about sustainability. I mean, we look at some of those species we've got up there, and Karkala is, you know, a prime example that is quite popular. So it's a succulent that comes from South Australia and the Coorong. And what gets worrying is with bush foods is that when they become popular, the pressure on wild resources is huge. So why not think about growing these things closer to the people who want to use them, and in a space that's possibly not even going to be used, and then take away those food miles and that impact to wild resources and create food steps, essentially. Mm. I mean, we like the idea that you could have gardens where chefs could be walking up to the top of the building that they're in and cutting fresh native foods. But also, I think the other thing was about promoting Indigenous knowledge about the environment is another thing that garden does. So it sort of does that. And that is good because sometimes the idea of food and drink is where we bring people in, but then they actually then come away with a much deeper understanding because they start to go past that. So, you know, they're all for the native cocktails, yeah. And don't worry, I am too. But then they get this deeper understanding about, you know, whether it be about particular species being, you know, culturally significant, or the fact that Indigenous people just didn't wander around and find a feed. There was an environmental management and land management component.
I think that's people tend to think that wild ingredients are just naturally more sustainable, and it kind of is up to a point when they get over harvested in the wild, and it's kind of got to be done in the right way. So obviously the more sustainable step is, as native ingredients become more popular on menus, is to actually, you know, cultivate them, farm them, you know, closer to where they are. Australia is such a massive country that, yeah, air miles and travel time is such a massive thing when you're trying to, you know, source these ingredients.
Did you, I mean, you mentioned before the involvement of chefs and the hospitality industry in coming up and gaining an understanding of these products and things like that. Was this, I mean, we see in the media and we see on menus, like Simon just mentioned, how it's just proliferated the use of native and Indigenous ingredients on menus all around Australia, in bars and in restaurants, and we'll talk about cosmetics soon as well. But was the hospitality industry and the interest shown by chefs something that kind of, was it a sort of a trigger to allow you to give you some impetus to make this sort of work? Like, how much did chefs and hospitality play a role in what you were doing up there?
Yeah, well, it was interesting, I suppose. I mean, I suppose at first we just thought about, well, what sort of reach can we get, and with food, and obviously we're aware of a number of people, and but then when we actually opened the rooftop, how much interest was shown, and then we were shocked. I mean, we got invited to the Delicious Awards, and we'd sitting there thinking, oh yeah, this is pretty cool, and there's a native producer thing, and then we won it, and we were like, wow, that's pretty bizarre. I mean, and then just the chefs that we're talking to, and then the profile of the rooftop, and I think it's because of that idea of that sustainable approach. We've had some pretty amazing chefs come and visit us, but I mean, the other great thing is that, you know, chefs that are down the street, or I mean, even now in this, you know, this COVID time of people cooking at home, I mean, all the interest we've had around, and we've been doing our native cocktail thing as a Zoom course where the stuff comes home, and I think it's this really cool thing. There's this combination of hospitality and chefs, and then there's also about people getting a bit of a local interest in where they are around food, and I think that's a really cool thing, thinking what's endemic to their area and maybe putting it in their gardens. But yeah, I think what we really enjoy is that... I think for Australia, sometimes what our identity is sometimes lost in food. And I think the great thing about native ingredients is that A, it can have that broader Australian context, but then also, you know, somewhere like the South Coast where Simon is, you know, you can really think, pull things that have just essentially just come from just down the street.
Yeah.
And I think that has such a good narrative around it. It's great.
I think like food in general is, you know, breaches cultures and brings people together. And it gives you a connection to the country you're in and the land you're in. I mean, one of the things that moving to Australia 8 years ago, the fact that no one was talking about native ingredients, and really was even aware there were kind of native ingredients here because it wasn't in media, but no one was talking about it. And most of the countries in Europe have sort of started to go back to, even the UK, which has got like a pretty bad reputation for food at times, has gone back to their kind of traditional heritage and a lot of origin of native species. And Australia's got some of those amazing and diverse plants and animals here, and they just really weren't used. So I think it's definitely a good step of bringing people together, bringing cultures together, teaching people about, you know, the history of this country and the culture. Like some of the things that, just from talking to people like Christian and Fred down south and other people, like every time I just learn something like ludicrous or learn about an ingredient that's got like the highest vitamin C or it's like this is for you or this is how it grows, it's so fascinating that I think people, once they have access to some information or be able to see these ingredients, it's really hard not to become quite fascinated with them.
Mm. And I guess chefs always have such a reverence, like, I mean, at a top level, they always have such a reverence for the ingredients that they source, whether they be indigenous or not. They, like, at the top level, chefs want to know who produces their food, and they want to know the story behind their food, and they want to pay respect to that when they put it on a plate and serve it to people. And if they can convey that story through the way that their food served in the restaurant and stuff like that, yeah, too. I mean, it's a sort of a natural progression.
People love it, like, to add value, when you're especially at sort of top-end cooking, to add value to what you're doing, people love the story behind it. And there's probably no greater, like, story than the kind of the history of this country that most people just don't know about. So that kind of adds, like, for us, what we're doing at Caveau, that just added another level of fascination for us and our customers. And it was always, you know, very well received and, you know, quite eye-opening for people with a little bit of information we'd supply with some of the ingredients we were serving.
Yeah, I think a great thing for our mob is to see, I suppose, our knowledge being brought into the broader community's area, so that food, as you said, brings people together. Then people start to think about, well, okay, maybe I should start to be thinking a little bit more about where this comes from. And then, as you say, like, it seems to have started up at the upper level of food, but I think now it's getting down to where people can think about, you know, more of a street food type thing. And I think the great thing, as I said, people now perceive some of these ingredients as accessible for them to use themselves. And I think that's what's really cool, is it's like, probably previously, as you said, it was probably certain chefs who were like, okay, you go somewhere. I mean, I grew up eating kangaroo, and I'm pretty sure that when kangaroo was first served, it was like in really, really high-end restaurants. And, and, you know, and it's like, I look at it and go, what? I can go out and get a feed of kangaroo. But, you know, it's got a few native ingredients. I don't think, I'm thinking, I'm in the wrong game.
Kangaroo only became, like, legal to serve in a restaurant in, like, 1993. Something which is like, just fucking ludicrous to me.
Yeah.
You have this like amazing, you know, quite sustainable meat resource in Australia that's delicious, that just was not seen as even a food until,
and I think,
you know,
people freak
20
out
years ago
because they think that they're cute.
Yeah,
there's a whole interesting discussion.
We've had a bit of backlash from when we did a thing on Studio 10 when we cooked kangaroo. We had quite a few 1-star reviews on Facebook and some emails. I posted like a wallaby tail pasta dish like for a dinner we did the other day, and we had like same again, the people being like, oh my god, how can you eat a kangaroo?
Wow.
They're so cute.
It's sustainable.
A couple of vegans getting on us as well.
Hopefully we get past that like quite quickly, and I think that hopefully we are with what we're talking about now and the way that food culture is moving and an understanding of sustainability.
Mm. Yeah, but
you can't argue with sustainability science and, you know, land management practices because it's just more sustainable.
The narrative of Aboriginal history said is that nomadic, bush tucker, foraging kind of lifestyle, which isn't true. So maybe you want to just sort of discuss maybe the sort of narrative has been of that nomadic bush tucker, pick it, eat it just to survive.
Yeah, I think that the idea of the, you know, the noble savage and that, you know, they just walked around in small groups, and, you know, it's almost like they're like, we all lived in the desert, and
yeah.
You know, whereas most of Australia clings to the eastern seaboard and all of these. So, I mean, you're talking about essentially, you know, over 300 different cultures in Australia, and language and cultural practice is driven by your environment. So, you know, if you live in a coastal environment, you've got a different lens on the landscape as you too, as if you live in the snowy mountains where my grandparents come from, or whether you come from the desert, or they're all got different ways of seeing the world, and that's in their food as well, and how they manage that space. And I think, yeah, there are harsh parts of the country where you would have been, you know, but it was, in many cases, what they were moving for was not food, it was water. And I mean, the interesting thing is, when you think about the history of Sydney, and I've done some work on a few garden designs doing research, is that, you know, through this area and down to the south, down to Randwick, if you look on the early map, it's called the Barren Dunes. And basically, it was seen as a desert here, even like right here. It was full of bush sucker and medicine plants and amazing, you know, refuges. And probably, luckily, early on, that meant that was a space that the local Aboriginal groups could be in while, you know, the water was being poisoned in the tank stream by all the people that were here in the early settlements. So what is seen as barren is another person's, you know, plentiful plate. So I think you're right. I think the great thing is that what better way to talk about food origin, you know, people talk about food origin and know where it came from. Well, what better food origin when it's like a 10,000-year-old story about a particular plant, about how you manage it. So
Can we talk about then, I mean, you've mentioned how chefs would come up to Yerrabinjin and pick a few things here and there, but it's not at the scale to be able to be a sort of a commercial farm. Yeah. What sort of ways, and we were talking before we started about some of the things that you're interested in or looking at doing in terms of doing things on a bigger scale and a more, and, you know, producing sustainable native plants and things like that to a commercial market. What sort of things have you sort of looked at, or where do you see some you know, positive prospects for the future in those sorts of things?
Well, we're definitely wanting to see an ethical supply chain be created that is easy to access. And I think there are many chefs and many people and who want native products and want native plants who would love to be able to go straight to the Aboriginal community and invest in them, but find it difficult. So. And it's difficult to navigate, and sometimes there's companies that look like they're Indigenous owned and they're not, or they might be partially Indigenous owned, but then you don't know how much of that money goes into the community. So there's a few major Indigenous producers that we've been talking to, and that idea of setting up this ethical supply chain, but then also giving the communities themselves the opportunity to grow plants again, that, you know, and replenish that practice. Yeah, so the idea is that we're going to put together a number of us and see a way that we can actually bring stuff to market on a commercial scale. And we're looking at food, but we're also looking at a lot of the projects I'm involved in now is about designing commercial landscapes that have forageable components for them, but also about bringing endemic species back into that landscape. So people being able to read the landscape as it once was. Mm. And then, again, then there's this whole thing about, well, you know, there's superfoods, there's properties of oils and things like that, and that we're really interested in investigating and helping communities sort of essentially build capital in their own communities, and that's like cultural capital, not just economic capital as well.
Mm. So what, like, we're talking about the ethical supply chain, and I think that, like, we might be assuming that our listeners understand what the issue is. Can you talk a bit about why we face an issue when it comes to an ethical supply
bush
chain?
Food, so, for example, the bush food industry is probably getting up around 80 million at the moment. Less than 3% of that is supplied by Indigenous companies. But there are a lot of companies that sound Indigenous, or, you know, or they've... And I think that, you know, the issue is there also is that... I mean, intellectual property gets talked about a lot, but actually there's more community, you know... Intellectual property is probably a better way, because, you know, these things are about, you know, particular groups and regions.
It's like acquired knowledge.
Yeah, and I think the only way for often that to be protected properly is that they are the ones actually running the business and taking the advantage of that opportunity. And, you know, the social... I mean, that's the thing, as Indigenous people, our social relationships brings a certain different style of social capital to the discussion. So the groups that I've been talking to is very much about how do we manage, you know, some of these companies that come in and want to, you know, buy out knowledge and or buy out names of things, or as soon as something starts to move, they want to be on that. And if you look at other countries where superfoods have taken off, say South America, all of a sudden, I mean, Kakadu plums a good example here. Gobinj is, you know, it's probably getting too expensive for the community that used to live off that species. Yeah, so right. I think it'd be cool to be able to also create the nutritional opportunity for remote and regional communities to be able to have those things available to them very at a wholesale level, and then what would they like to offer the market? And that's what we're trying to do, is it can be a different scale or scope, it can be large, but it's like a bit of a sort of a collective idea around supply chain. So, you know, different communities could be growing different species that have very much come from their areas, and then the market can access it directly and say, well, they know that this has come. And that ethical part is about what, you know, has the person, if you do a parallel with art, so Indigenous art, there's some issues around the way Indigenous artists were treated and whether they're paid fairly and so forth. So if this market is rising, it should create a massive community benefit rather than maybe just like a short little boom for certain people. I mean, I've heard different companies saying, oh, we employ Aboriginal people. And it's like, well, then that's good, but what do you employ them to do? Go and pick fruit. You know, it would be better if they were being employed to be the CFO or the CEO or something like that. So I think we're hoping also to look at the opportunity to actually define a brand with community around what that looks like, and rather than someone possibly come in and do it. So is it, you know, those community endorsed ethical supply chains and then the story is there, then that means you can, as a chef, you'll be able to talk directly to that community about what that plant means to them, so that not only when they're cooking it, they actually know enough about it to pay that proper respect.
Yeah, the knowledge of cooking some of these ingredients, like a lot of time it's, if you have access to someone who knows about it, it's been massive trial and error. And I had some Balubi yams from Northern Territory, and like on Meningrida is a kind of social company in Arnhem Land who harvest wild ingredients and supply them. They'd put some Instagram videos of them cooking these little blueberry yams, and they came out like beautiful, creamy, like amazing little vegetables. And I tried everything. I tried like in coal, on top of coal, like sous vide them, fermenting them, like brining them, all these things, and I couldn't get them like to a point where I thought like I could use them. And I was looking at their stories, and I was like, how? And they're like, you're gonna have to come up here and they'll have to show you. And like that access to information, I think is kind of important to put the ingredients in context and being able to use them properly.
So I mean,
it's hard to catch up with 80,000 years.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, that's what I was going to. It's such a mammoth task, Christian, because there's so many different things that we're talking about. I think that, like, something that you mentioned before was, you know, potentially finding new ways to cultivate these ingredients and locating them closer to metropolitan areas to enable easier access and supply. But then there's I'm going to make an assumption, but there's probably ingredients out there that have to be foraged that you can't necessarily cultivate on a commercial scale. We also talk about the involvement of communities around Australia and getting that supply chain. So, like, in what does sort of an ideal sort of landscape of ethical supply look like to you down the track?
So, yeah, I think you're right. The combination of urban agriculture, commercial approach, and then I think the key leverage can be, I mean, in New South Wales, Aboriginal groups own, you know, significant pieces of land that currently, some of them are environmentally sensitive, so they can't have development on them, but what they can have is they can have the replenishment of the natural landscape. And I think that's another opportunity is that it can actually, and particularly post bushfire, that some of these species can be reintroduced onto land to not only create a forageable economic outcome, but an environmental restorative outcome. So I think that's a great opportunity, is that, you know, these species were there naturally and they've been cleared, and, you know, and because they weren't seen as value, and then in many cases that land, be them in arid regions and other regions, is now of less value. But if it had those plants restored into the space, and then also that would then create better water quality. There's so many environmental benefits. the cultural benefits of those communities having those plants back in their endemic plants back in their landscape, and then the opportunity to be able to forage them, and because I think those ones, and then you say there's the sort of, okay, what are the species we want to be able to propagate, bring, and that might be also not just about ones that we want to harvest, but it might be about taking them back out to communities. And then other ones for us are about when we're doing landscaping stuff in commercial projects about species that we want to teach people about. And I think that's the other great thing about it is that people learn so much off these plants, not just about eating them, but their place in the landscape. And when everyone talks about dark emu and the Murnong, the Munyang, the daisy yam, such a important plant, not because it was just because it was a staple, but about what it says about the myth of indigenous land management not existing, and the fact that this is a plant that needed active management. And so I think that's probably the idea, is a sort of this blended approach. And I mean ultimately it would be great to see all the land that's owned by Aboriginal community have those species restored onto them. But then it's great for people to turn around and go, you know what, I want to put this in my backyard, I want to put this on my balcony, because again what we're also doing is helping all of our birds and bees and all those sorts of things by creating diversity, and even doing it by having a rooftop in the city is helping.
I'm desperate to get some Murnong on a menu. Like ever since I read Dark Emu, I was like, oh my god, I want that vegetable.
Well, again, they're an interesting one, because if you get them at the wrong time, the taste can go very, very horrible. And there are different species too, so I mean that's interesting. There's an alpine version and a few others, and so there's got a slightly different trick to them. But
This is the kind of maze that we've had to go down of the names and variations of species within kind of like Kakala, for example, seems to be lots of different species of pig's face, and there's different ones from South Australia that grow here, and they all get kind of put under this one umbrella of name. So from a kind of restaurant point of view, when you're ordering like a lily pilly, you don't know which species of lily pilly it's going to be.
And they all seem to be really sour.
Yeah, and they seem to grow at different times. Like even in just Wollongong area, you see different, slightly different variations, different trees, you know, coming to fruit at different times of the year. And then obviously the knowledge of knowing what they are and how to use them, and their tastes and benefits is quite a maze, which again is why we need information about these things.
Is Murnong commercially available? Can you get it?
No. So, I mean, up until recently, it was a threatened species. Well, it still is a threatened species, technically. So very much Victoria, a couple of major nurseries started propagating it again. And we've got some on the rooftop that we got a couple of parent plants and then propagated them. The seeds are like a dollar a seed.
Jesus.
Yeah, wow. So, but then the aim is, and that's what I want to get space where is to, used to have meadows of them essentially, and that's how much of them you get. And this idea of bringing that practice back in, and I think that's the great thing about it is that chefs want to use this stuff, and then I think the community want to be back involved in having these things available, not just about the production of food, but about how that impacts and creates positive outcomes in their communities, about that practice being returned, I think is another great thing. You know, getting young people involved in this space, getting them out in there and propagating your plants and stuff, I think is for many young people is something that they would enjoy rather than maybe, pouring a coffee.
Sure.
Christian, when we talk about the difficulty that chefs and maybe cosmetic producers and things like that have in potentially deciphering what is Indigenous owned or what is ethical supply chain, what are some of the sort of issues you see there, and is there a way that we can make that process easier for people using these ingredients?
Yeah, well, I mean, even us as 100% Indigenous owned business find it difficult. So it's literally having to really like go into this space of investigating it, and I suppose that's probably what we've started to see is that, say for instance, like the developers and the landscape architects and architects that we work with and everything, they're sort of saying, Christian, how can we make this a bit easier? And I suppose that's the idea, is we're trying to think about, well, okay, how can the ones that we know about start to reach out to other ones and become a sort of a collaborative network, A, that helps, we can help each other, but then B, is identifiable as almost a collective brand. And I think that's what we're looking at is, it's like, you know, people talk about organic and all that sort of stuff, and that sort of stuff. Sort of, but we're just thinking, well, okay, what should it look like? This, if someone really wants to do the right thing, and I mean, there's some pretty interesting examples recently where people probably thought they were using, you know, Indigenous-owned products, supplied products, especially around beauty products and stuff like that, and then get found out that it's not, and then they get hammered, essentially. I think they're trying to do the right thing, and that's, so I think we need more producers in the space, because as I said, you're probably talking about 3%, and there's a whole suite of issues around the barriers that are there for Indigenous people to get into business, and that's one of the things that we looked at is, you know, we really want to take our experience and try and help people who want to do stuff. You know, what would normally happen in the industry is you're probably looking to, you know, beat everybody down, you know, be the top of it. But that's definitely what we want to do. We actually see there's so much space. It's more about, you know, they always talk about the piece of the pie and everything. Well, you know, there's everybody's still got ingredients they can bring before the pie even gets cooked in this space, I think. Mm. And there's lots of depth of knowledge. And I think we've initially started to look at some companies in New South Wales, but now starting to reach out to companies across Australia who are Indigenous companies who have a similar, I suppose, ethos to us and have approached it. And then how do we come together and start to create that sort of network that'll support it and then make it identifiable and easy for chefs or, you know, any other people who want to get a hold of produce that's actually come from communities and ethically come from communities. Mm.
Yeah. Do you see that taking the form of, I mean, you mentioned organic, like, the way we got to organic certification in this country was through a long process of figuring out what that means and what that looks like. And then now it's you have to go through, jump through legal hoops essentially or get the right practices in place in order to be certified organic. Do you see something similar working in this space?
You've got Supply Nation and some people probably have gone through that. And Supply Nation, that essentially concentrates on Indigenous procurement policy spaces, but you can be certified if you're 50% Indigenous owned, which is, you know, in some instances that's really good, but I mean, some instances you're talking about, that's always, they say registered is 50%, 51% Indigenous owned is certified Indigenous business. Now, the other 49% could be owned by a massive multinational in China, but it would, for all intents and purposes, look very similar to 100% owned business. So our model was very much, when we went forward, was not about sort of being one of these sort of cliched, it's often called black cladding. What the other idea was, you know, I'm an Indigenous business owner. I want to run my business, and we do run our business exactly the same as any other business does in Australia. It happens to be that, you know, the person who owns it is Indigenous, but then we also want to be able to then invest in Indigenous entrepreneurs. And so we're down the track keen to see how we can, whether it be our experience for mentoring or investment or attract investment for other companies to basically grow the share that Indigenous companies have.
Do you worry? Do you worry, especially? I mean, and maybe we can maybe talk about this in the beauty products sort of sphere as well, because you mentioned before we started about just how much it's proliferating in that space. Do you worry that if this isn't activated in, like, that you kind of face a time scale or something needs to happen within a certain amount of time, or things will get lost? Because I'm gonna just spitball, but like, in the beauty product space, it seems to me that the story of an ingredient isn't told in the same way that it is in the food industry, and potentially the reverence for an ingredient isn't shared to the same level as chefs have for it. So someone purchasing a face cream that has Kakadu plum in it on Instagram from a maker, they've heard of Kakadu plum and they know that it's good for your skin or whatever it might be.
Yeah,
and
on the health benefits, and they want more it, than the story.
They want it in the ingredient. Yeah, they want the ingredient. Do you see the story being lost in that industry more so? Like, is that a concern?
Yeah. And again, there are some really good Indigenous producers who are getting involved at a certain scale. But that market is huge.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's about them wanting to understand these, you know, essentially from us, medicinal properties. I mean, we see food as medicine as well. So, Yeah, I think it's hard because you're competing with these massive companies who will come in, and if I'm a small indigenous company and some big large company comes to buy my knowledge, and then I get a short term win out of it, it's hard to, when you're by yourself, to go, oh well, this is a great way for me to sustain myself. But yeah, then ultimately after that, many there are a few businesses
kind of breaks that generational wealth chain then of selling something for a short term gain, and doesn't actually but then help your kids and their kids, and that's not
I think the interesting thing in Australia was is very much, and I think this is where Indigenous people want to go with their companies, is we were very much about, you know, before the share market and all that sort of stuff, is that strong companies were about, you know, almost like this family model.
Mm.
You know, small to medium enterprises was what Australia was built on, and then we sort of all of a sudden jumped into this global space where it's all about shareholders and it's got nothing to do with about the people who work for you or whatever. So I think the space that I think that Indigenous companies can go back into is actually being these... I mean, there are some good Australian companies who do this, and I think there are a lot of European companies. It's number of places, such as Scandinavia and Germany, and that where they actually small to medium enterprises is very much the way they like their market to operate.
Kind of going back into more owned by the community, owned by the workers kind of models.
Yeah, and that's what I think for Indigenous communities is the opportunity. And the good thing is that they can have that at whatever scale suits them, delivers for them. And the good thing is there's, you know, they can feel empowered to say no, and I think that must be hard when you're someone who has, you know, a big multinational in your face saying, hey, we'll give you this crazy amount of money that you probably never thought you'd never hear of. And then it's like, well, what do I do? And then, you know, am I selling my mob out? And look, don't get me wrong, there is a whole larder full of stuff that is not even out there, and it's rightly not out there because community are very wary and scared about what's going to happen. Most of the stuff that we talk about is already in the public domain. So, you know, stuff that's not known, if we have it in the garden or whatever, we don't tend to talk about it too much. So, yeah, it's that idea about how do you build cultural sensitivity into what you're putting out there in the market. And I do know some guys who produce stuff that they produce, you know, stuff that the market, to go to the market, so that they can produce other stuff just for their community. And I think that's the other great thing about co-designing these approaches is the community can decide how they want that to work. And it might be that they just want to... We even looked at our model to include things like community-to-community trading. So that what used to happen traditionally around trade can happen again. So that community can say, here, we want to swap 10 kilos of this for 10 kilos of what you've got. And they can have a native diet. I mean, that's the great thing about it. I mean, so I think it's really hard. And I think that's what needs to happen is I... With it needs to be pushed so that people can say, well, yeah, all right, we've got Kakadu plum in it, but, you know, do I want to know that this has come from the community with their endorsement, or is it actually being ripped off them and bought out by a company, and then nothing really goes into them except some small money that was paid up front?
I mean, it just comes down to educating the public and making people more aware of this, because for a lot of people, it wouldn't be even on their radar to think that, you know, this might be an issue, that this company that's not Aboriginal owned is using these things, and you know, how are they getting the ingredient is kind of forgotten about. So I think it's just, I mean, especially recently, there's been a lot of posts full of, like, you know, Instagram accounts and social media about, you know, black owned businesses and companies that do, you know, do things the right way and promoting them, and I guess that's just kind of a small step to educating the public.
Well, it's like that supply chain thing. I mean, if the only way to have it work properly is that Indigenous companies have to own and manage the entire supply chain, everything from production right up to distribution and marketing, and it may not be all the same company, but I think that's what we're sort of talking about, is there are so many good companies with different capacities that if we join up and work and sort of manage that, well, then we can essentially say, look, well, you know, this is you can know that you're not going to be, you know, you're not going to be fucked over, essentially, because we're all looking to share it rather than destroy each other. And I think that is another game with Indigenous companies. We're not trying to put each other into the ground. We're actually trying to help each other grow our profile in the market.
Is there any sort of conversation with policymakers or government about getting involved in putting in legislation about ownership and about how different businesses can practice in this industry, because our government talks about bridging the gap, and this we're talking about here, employment opportunity. Is there any talk of in this space with policymakers?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, government investment in this space and business and everything, I find a little bit problematic. So, it can do. Often I see that, you know, we went through and we're not going to go for grants, we're not going to go for this, because I think sometimes as people see that as revenue and stuff like that, and then essentially you get held over to that revenue. And I think for government, it does need to think about. I mean, the proper economic sustainability has to have an equal, you know, support from government, private industry, and the community. It'd be interesting, because I mean, obviously it's free trade these days, so it's, you know, it's we live in a liberal world, and, you know, if you do well, good luck to you, and if you don't, tough luck to you, is essentially the approach that they put out there. And looking to a certain extent, you know, not every Indigenous person will, you know, being in business, it takes a certain amount of drive, it takes different skills. I mean, I went back and studied, you know, such a broad range of things. I mean, it's probably one of the, you've really got to have so many skills and so many spaces to be successful at business. And I think that's where communities need to think about, well, okay, what are those skills we need in our community? I mean, you can have the knowledge, but then how do you deliver that into a space where it's going to, as Simon said, have long-term social benefit to the community because it's managed well. But the upside is, I think, is that getting to this stage allows communities to decide where that money's spent. And I think with you know, a lot of programs that are government funded, that a lot of that money is caught up in administration. Whereas I think empowering community is definitely part of it, is about going through this private commercial way that you make the calls. I mean, you know, you can make your mistakes and then you can make your wins, and essentially that's what being in business is. But at the moment it's sort of like risk is not taken because you've got to say, oh, okay, your funding's coming from somewhere else. Whereas if you're making the call, you make the call, you do it.
Yeah, I think the government policy seems to be kind of tokenistic at best a lot of time of well, look, we've got this grant there. Like, we've done something. So,
Or we'll buy all our stationery off this particular. I mean, they talk about 3% procurement policies. I mean, look, I think they're great if they help people start out but if you stay in that little pond, if you just stay in that little pond of that space of government sort of contracts and stuff like that, you're not really growing as an enterprise and not really growing your skills as an enterprise, and that's the thing. But I think if it's great, if that gets you a leg up and you take that, and it's the seed that turns you into a big tree. But for us, we're a small company, but you know, you don't have to dream big. I think you can say, well, I'm happy to be in the niche I'm in, but you know, how many Aboriginal CEOs have we got in ASX 200 companies? We haven't got any Indigenous ASX 200 listed companies. I mean, that's one of the things I'm super keen to see, whether it's us or somebody, be on the share market and be publicly listed. And some people think, well, you know, that's just a weird corporate world, but it's like, well, no, that's where a lot of big decisions get made what happens in the future of our kids. So let's get into that space and have our own voice there rather than being chucked on something as a token.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think that's Indigenous representation in hospitality is kind of an issue. You don't see many Indigenous chefs working in high-end restaurants. Suppliers are still, obviously, like I said, 3%. Even things like winemaking and viticulture. Mm. Like, I don't know of any Indigenous winemakers or wine growers particularly. I'm sure there are some out there. But it's definitely an issue to move forward on, especially on the food and wine side, because that does have that kind of historical and cultural importance of growing things and managing this land and managing it in a better way. Especially when it comes to things like water resources in wine, that's such a massive issue. And there's so much to be learned from the history of this country that way. So it's definitely something which I'm not entirely sure how to make this better, but it's definitely something I think everyone needs to look into, for having that more representation.
Yeah, I guess one of my, I don't know, when I asked that question, I was sort of also thinking about, in terms of ethical supply chains, like, is there any place for government to step in and put in regulations around how it can work, like how those things can be implemented and create a system? Because as we talk about bridging the gap, when ethical supply chains aren't created, that that industry is passed away from Indigenous ownership. And if they can help facilitate an ethical supply chain, then ownership can be taken. Is that something on the radar at all?
If they got involved, but I think the problem is that they as I said, they have this idea of not getting, you know, not restricting trade. Saying yes, we'll invest in Indigenous businesses, and the way they do it is about, you know, writing business plans and whatever. But ultimately, Indigenous people have less access to capital. And that's what gets you. That's what gets your skin in the game.
Is money,
you
know, makes money.
So, you know, Yerrabingin was regarded as a visionary startup, but technically we're not a startup because we didn't get anyone else's money. We threw our own money in there. We bootstrapped ourselves, and not many people are able to do that. And what you find with Indigenous entrepreneurs is they're usually a lot older. They do that sort of thing. They bring their investment in. I mean, there's organisations such as Indigenous Business Australia and stuff, but again, there's this thing about, you know, oh, we've got grants and things like that, but there's multiple hoops to jump through. Whereas when you're at the beginning of your business, you want to be able to really, it is all about that, all that passion and drive that gets you in there. And then if you're spending a lot of time sort of
bogged down
and essentially talking to people that aren't even in the business space. I mean, they're in a government space, so they're just don't understand the pace of things, and you find it very frustrating. And successful Indigenous entrepreneurs that I talk to usually go on their bat. They just go to the bank, they get the money, they have a crack, and then it's just like, you know. And then often what happens is that some of these organisations come to us and say, "Hey, yeah, you want to get involved with us?" It's like, well, we've already gone past that point of you know needing mentoring and things like that. And that's the thing about businesses is mentoring is good, but I think you should be choosing who your mentor is. It's someone who fits your approach, and that might not be an Indigenous person. You know, I've got a couple of people that I talk to, and it's because I'm impressed by the way that they think and how they approach business. That's an interesting thing. I mean, you're probably entrepreneurs in the broader community are a lot younger, and I think again that's something that'd be great if we have more young Indigenous people who feel that they can take their ideas and essentially, you know, overnight become CEO. You know, there's 20-year-old CEOs out there. I don't think there's any 20-year-old Indigenous CEOs.
Is Yerrabingin your first business, Christian?
Yes.
Wow.
So I was pretty lucky. But I mean, again, I think it was going and doing the study that we did. I think really, and it was, you know, with UTS, I think it's so strongly connected to the industry. And then one thing I really got right into was this whole thing about design thinking, which is what we use for our design approach, we use to think about it. And it started off in the weird tech UX world, but I mean, it's the idea is that what you're building is human-centered, it's empathetic, and that's interesting that started in the tech space, because they do that because they obviously want to draw upon emotion. But when you think about it from the point of building a garden, rather than what are the plants going to be, it's like, well, how's someone going to feel when they come to this space? And then the great thing is while you're designing what plants go in, you're also designing who's going to use it and how they're going to use it. And that's a great thing from a community's perspective, because you can have so many people with different experiences contribute to a new innovative idea. And I think that's what's I learned so much from there is that this probably, you know, what we did here, we do solution design. We just happen to be doing... We did these gardens here, and I think we're always up for something new, and that's essentially our business. So hopefully that keeps us in good stead, because we're always trying to do something new.
It's great. I think it's a classic example of sort of you don't know till you need it until you've got it, and then you realise we need more of it.
Well, we were just surprised that no one else has done it. The weird thing is that's the business sweet spot. If you step into somewhere that essentially everyone goes, oh no, and our biggest problem was that we were getting hammered with everybody. Can you be involved in this? Can you be involved in that? And you know, like if I'd had tons and tons and tons of produce to sell the first couple of months we were up there, we were getting rung up and approached by everybody. I mean, there was a bit of a Google storm on us for a while. Yeah.
Cool. But what else? So obviously we've spoken about the garden and how important it is for people to have that kind of on their doorstep. How can people come and visit? What kind of things are you guys doing up there?
Yeah, so obviously we're sort of, you know, walking our way through this strange times around. So normally we, you know, they're able to actually access things such as our native cocktail course on the rooftop and other events. They're able to often hire the place out. But at the moment, obviously, we've had to, because of the restrictions, it's essentially closed. So then we went, so we've got virtual tours at the moment of our garden. So people, we were like, okay, so many people ring us up. We're like, okay, well, we'll just try and work out how we use Zoom to, the evil Zoom. Because everyone's like, oh, people can jump in on it. It's like,
yeah,
oh,
a bunch of shares in Zoom would have been good, eh?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, but the idea is once we get into a sort of a pre-COVID world is people can come back into the space. So we've had different events, we've had music, we've people during the day. When it's back open again, you can just actually drop in. So it's a public space. And then if you look at our website, there's other opportunities depending. So if we run different workshops, but yeah, and then obviously the landscape garden, which is the other garden we've opened.
Yeah, just went down there before.
Yeah,
just down the road from.
Yeah, so that was actually our first project. It just took a lot longer because it's in the construction zone. So there's So the other one was like, hey, can you guys do this? And they were like, yeah. And so that idea of that is it does have food species in it. Some of the larger ones couldn't grow on the roof and a whole bunch of other ones. But then it's also about sort of, you know, this endemic cultural landscape around here. And it's actually part of the heritage interpretation plan. So the idea is that you're learning about all this fantastic civil rights history that you get around South Eveleigh, which is so important for... you know, local Aboriginal people, but also, you know, for migrants and women that happen on this site. But then the idea is you get another layer. So it's making sure that the mosaic has all pieces in it, not just, you know, the sort of, people can get a bit, you know, especially people who've got weird fascinations with trains, can get a little bit excited about trains and forget that there's a whole thousands of years of other stuff that happened here before they started building trains here.
It's like, we're walking down, we first got in, it's just like 10 lemon myrtle trees, which I was like, oh my god, this is like forager's dream.
Yeah,
and I've lived around here, I'll be coming here at night and pillaging them. But like things like that just smell really good, and I don't know why they're not used more in public spaces. Like you walk past, you know, so many different myrtles and gums, and you walk past them, they just smell fucking amazing.
Yeah,
and they just seem like the perfect things to put in place like this, but they're just not. Also, it'd be great if I could forage.
Well, and the great thing is it's organic. You don't have to use pesticides and stuff on them because they're natives, and that's what one of the ideas. I mean, what we would hope here is, and that's what we're sort of pushing on other developments is to say to these big developers, when you're building commercial landscapes, put the trees back that were there, or bring in lots of natives. And again, this means that there's parts of this landscape is now forageable. Smells great. You can bring kids here, and we've got curriculum we designed for local school kids.
Yeah, yeah.
So that the kids can come over, walk over here, and see stuff, and tell each other about it, and say, "Look, there's lemon myrtle," and you can make that into a tea.
It's fascinating. My friend Jared, who owns Birth and Death, his partner's kids, he takes them foraging all the time, and whenever they're walking around now, they're like looking in the gardens and picking little things, and like they're just naturally fascinated by it. It's definitely, you know, education from a young age about things like this is going to be key.
I think it's one of those cases where it's like, oh, you know, people don't use it normally, so that mustn't work.
Yeah.
And even when we're doing stuff on the rooftop, they're like, oh, can you put natives on a rooftop? And it's like, well, can you put any plants on a rooftop? Yep. Yeah. Well, then natives, and that's like we're designing some indoor landscapes and some major developments in Sydney, and being able to bring those smells and that into an office and have people, you know, sort of blur the edge between the landscaping and the building, especially some of these monstrosities that are built around Sydney.
Yeah, yeah.
And so working with a couple of different companies around that idea about bringing natives, you know, and then the great thing is we sort of they say, well, how many natives can you get in there? And I said, well, you know, we've got to start trying some of them out. But, you know, in the same way that you bring... you know, rainforest species from other places and plonk them in your office. Well, we've got an amazing, you know, array of species in Australia. That's
such variety.
Yeah, and the great thing is again, you've got stuff in your office all of a sudden that's talking to the place you live in and the landscape you're on, and rather than, you know, some ugly plant called mother-in-law's tongue or something like that. And the reason they put them there is because you can't kill them.
Yeah,
they're exactly. like the cockroaches of plants.
They won't die.
All right. Look, we'll start wrapping it up because we've been going for a while now. But is there anything else you want to talk about, Christian? Anything else you've got going on?
Oh no, I think as Simon said, we're really keen to see, and you know, more Aboriginal people involved in driving hospitality in Australia, because it's really the tourism market that's so connected to this native hospitality is huge and is not met and is underutilized. I mean. there is millions of visitors that come to Sydney who, again, similarly to the way chefs are looking for an ethical product or are looking for an authentic Indigenous product. And they and there are a few really amazing operators, but it is difficult, and there's massive opportunities there. And food is definitely linked to it. I mean, I think one of the things I'm working on at the moment is this idea of working with UNESCO has these creative cities. And I learnt that, because there's six of them in Australia, and I think it's Ballarat is for gastronomy. So
right,
it's creative
right.
gastronomy. So they've got this, they're looking at this native bread making project there. And so we're now looking at this opportunity to sort of link up to all the, some of these international cities and see native grain and bread as the opportunity of a conversation space at an international level.
Like the bread making is like they found bread making tools dating back like 60,000 years in Australia, which kind of predates the Egyptians, which was normally considered the first people to make bread by like 40,000 years or something, which is like a ludicrous fact. So I mean, yeah, bread just seems like obviously has a massive historical and cultural importance.
Well, the great thing is the correlations too, I think, between different cultures. So when you think about like, so one of the mobs we're talking to is like Fabrizia and the Italians, again, a UNESCO city, and the extended family and the idea of food as a community thing. And I think, again, is something that's got, it's got so much opportunity for Australia to present itself that way.
There's so much connection. We did a dish for a like French dinner recently, and it was, I'd probably ruin the translation, but like on papillot, like cooked in paper, is you know, the same technique as cooking in paper bark. Mm-hmm. So I managed to do a translation like barramundi cooked in paper bark, but in French it was probably a really bad translation. But it was really like, it was great sort of putting that dish down and telling the customers of like, there's this technique, which is very classic French, and there's this very historical technique in Aboriginal culture, but they're basically the same thing, steaming fish in a little environment. And that kind of connection between like, you know, two sides of the world, completely different time frames, but you know, with very similar cooking techniques and kind of things like that. I always find
even hair making flour and stuff, I think, is an interesting, you know, cultural interaction and
grinding stones.
So I mean, that's something we just started chatting to, is this opportunity to bring together like multiple cities from around the world and discuss. In particular, we're very keen on in engaging with some of the Indigenous communities from around the world about where they are around, you know, their knowledge around native produce, and are they being able to utilize. I mean, there's First Nations people, it's very much more around, interesting enough, is more around things such as, you know, animal species and how they utilize those, whereas as we were talking earlier, people seem to be a bit scared to want to eat Australian native animals. I probably get a bit horrified, but I'm one of my favorite meats is echidna. So
really?
It's amazing. But you know, of course we don't want to go out and knock off a whole heap of the echidnas.
I mean
there's that whole thing about threatened species and everything too, about
goanna's delicious as well.
Some are not so good. I always told you, you think about what it eats before you eat it. So if it eats carrion, you're probably not going to taste too good. Even with kangaroos, I mean it's like any mammal, you know, not all cows are good to eat.
And that's kind of the point we're not quite at yet, is having that. I mean, there's a couple of companies like Paru do a really good job of sourcing the right species and the right sex at the right time in different areas. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating about bringing First Nations people together from around the world, because quite interesting, like a guy from Dom in Brazil, like what he's done for the rainforest and things, like that's, he seems to be kind of that extra step ahead of lots of things they're doing, like Peru and Brazil and things like that.
Well, and I think the other thing is interesting is when you start to look into it, I think there's Indigenous people in countries that people don't even realise that there are Indigenous people.
Yeah.
You know, such as Japan and you know, there's, I think that's another thing that I've through the UNESCO stuff, I'm thinking, well, this is pretty cool. I mean, that's the whole thing about, you know, intangible knowledge.
How can
it start to be protected? So, because some countries do it really well, they protect cultural practice, you know, song, language. I think language has just started in Australia, really. It's probably a little bit, you know,
I mean,
it's just going to help, but it's, I think
there's a bit of a wall in the way with Aboriginal language, with there being so many countries that it's hard, you know. One is kind of like, I remember hearing talk about kind of Indigenous national anthem, and people were like, well, what language?
Well, I was at a dinner where someone said that to me, and
maybe you told me
the Maori, because of course, you know, I mean, as an Indigenous person, I love, you know, the Maori language in the New Zealand. I mean, the New Zealand national anthem is so much better than ours. That's just crap. I don't know if ours would be. I don't think it would sound any better if you sang it in a different language.
Yeah.
But I remember someone saying to me at dinner. Well, we were at this dinner somewhere, one of the tourism awards or something, and this person just put me on the spot and said, "Oh, why can't we have an Indigenous national anthem?" And I said, "Well, we can, but it's got to have 350 verses, so we can all have one each."
Take a while.
So yeah, but I mean, I think sometimes it's good because again, like people start to understand the diversity. You know, they're not one big homogenous. And look, and there's lots of discussions about whether we call ourselves First Nations or Indigenous or Aboriginal or Blackfellas or whatever. Mm. I mean, my old nan used to sort of do her head in a little bit. But I think, you know, Indigenous, Aboriginal, they all mean the same thing, and they're not in our language anyway. But somehow there's got to be, you know, for people to be able to understand what... You know, who we are in the Australian landscape, and that's continually changes over time. I mean, I'm getting a little bit older, and when I was young, it was Aboriginal, or you know, my nan used to call them Blackfellas, or they'd say which mob they are, and then now we're going to the sort of First Nations, which seems to be adapting other areas, spaces. So, God knows what'll happen.
Yeah, next. I mean, language is obviously quite important. It's been a big focus on language recently. To some things, too. Maybe kind of pointless effect, but it is kind of it's an education for people to kind of learn about and to you know just ask what the best language is to use, really.
It's kind of
as easy as that. I was just like,
well, and the fact that we don't have a written language, obviously language is extremely important, as is songs and traditions, and that was how, you know, and stories that retain knowledge around how you do things and how you manage things in the environment are super important. So I think that's really good. I think it's just good when people understand. And I think currently some of the discussions I've had with some of the webinars we've done is people have during COVID have become very locally focused.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty cool thing. I think that can help also be similar with your, you know, what you want to know about Indigenous people is, you know, what is around you and as a landscape. And yeah, I mean, people, the fact that they're finding in the city, I mean, I'm obviously in Sydney, I was fascinated about how many people all of a sudden have decided that they need to go and walk in the nearest piece of bush every day.
Yeah,
that's because you're on Zoom the rest of the time. So that's what happens. So you've got to have Zoom happy hours. So, but yeah, and I think that people started to get a little bit more familiar with where they live and familiar with the places nearby them. And I think similarly, I think they started to get more familiar with thinking about, well, okay, what whose country am I on, and what was it like, and what is it like, and who are they?
Yeah.
Cool.
Anything else?
No.
No, I think we're good.
How can people find Yerrabingin?
Well, if you Google us, you'll get yerrabingin.com.au. It's probably the easiest thing. So you can contact us through that space. Obviously, on Instagram and Facebook. Instagram's probably where we pump out the most stuff. I'm not really good on Facebook, so that's someone else in my team.
It's just Yerrabingin on Instagram.
Yeah, or if you want to follow myself, I'm at Heathen Black.
Boom, nice.
A play on my name of Christian, because I am not one. I explained to some non-Australian people that in Australia we like to do that. If someone has red hair, we call them blue, and that is why I'm called Christian, because I'm a heathen.
Nice. All right. Cool. If people want to get in touch with this podcast, they can email us thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com and follow the Food Fight Podcast on Instagram as well. If you're out there and you want to talk to us, we want to talk to you. So get in touch because that's what we do. We talk to people. Christian, thank you so much for joining us, mate. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for putting up with all the noise.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.